Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And in studio with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. So it's all things gardening this morning, and we hope you'll call in with your questions or comments. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Don't wait till the end of the program. Call right now, 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's good to be here again.
Finally warming up a little bit again.
I don't know. You go outside, and I don't think it's that warm.
It felt pretty good yesterday afternoon compared to the day before. So.
Yeah, but when we have overnight temperatures that are down into the low 30s, that doesn't help things out very much. And, thank goodness we had a little bit of rain here, too, because it was really nice in March, and we were talking about all the fun things that we could do, and then it dried out, and I started seeing people run water on their lawns, and, things were getting a little bit, tenuous at times, and I wasn't worried about my lawn, but I was worried more about some of the stuff that people are putting in their gardens, because that surface dries out, and those seeds just have a little bit of a struggle then, and now we're back into the cool thing, so who can explain the weather? Rob doesn't do that good of a job. He forecasts it, but it would be nice to be able to look out into the crystal ball a little farther than what our weather people do. So,
well, my temperature gauge, which the sensor outside is under a tree and under a deck, was 25 a couple of mornings ago, and then it was 28 yesterday morning, and then this morning it was 33.
So have you picked any asparagus?
I have picked some.
Until it got frozen.
Until it got frozen.
That's my point. Those are the kinds of temperatures that we really don't want. We look at, coming to the end of April and into early May, and what we would expect our overnight temperatures to be are into the mid to upper 30s, and many of our plants can tolerate those kind of conditions, and then we get these continual periods of excessively colder night temperatures, and that can be really hard on some things, and certainly we should spend a little time talking about that as the hour progresses. So certainly if someone has a question, please get your question in, send it in to the Zesty Garden on gmail.com, I think it is, and or call in on the 1-800 number, because this is an opportunity for you to talk to me, and I like to listen to myself talk, but not that much.
And I can only ask so many questions.
That's right. So let's get our audience participating, because gosh, you may be out in the garden listening right now. That would be the time to do it, and you're going to see some things, and we can talk about them.
Again, that's 1-800-826-1495. So what's on my mind is I want to plant my zucchini, and I'm not going. I just quit trying to plant things indoors, because those stinking things will just. I plant them outside. They'll start off really well inside the house. I take them outside. I'm really gentle with them. I don't move those roots around very much that I'm thinking, and they just sit there for a couple of weeks before they actually do anything. So I thought I'm going to be better off if I just plant from seed outside.
And we can kind of talk about that. We have a project that we're working on right now that looks at how to condition plants to deal with the transition from the nice environment of your plant growing area, which most of our commercial nurseries have greenhouses. They hold the day temperature, about 75, and at night they bring the temperature down maybe to 60 to 65. And when you're looking at those kind of conditions, that's really what plants like. Those are the ideal conditions for the growth of those particular plants, whether we're talking about broccoli or tomatoes. And then you decide to take them out of that nice environment and quickly put them out into a really harsh, unforgiving type of environment. Very bright sunlight during the day. If you kind of get down really close to the ground, and sometimes you have to do it that way, get really close to the ground, put your hand on the top of the soil, feel how warm it is right at the surface. There's a microzone right there near the surface that's really warm. Yet when you're go a few inches down into the soil, it can be quite cool again. So you've got plants that are dealing with all of this, colder roots. They had warm roots in the greenhouse. You have warmer leaves, bright, bright sunshine compared to a little bit of shading that's occurring in the greenhouse. They may have already put some whitewash on it, something to kind of filter some of that light out. Nice temperatures to harsh temperatures, warm days, cool nights, cold nights, freezing nights. You know, we get them all out in the field. And those plants, yeah, yuck, I can see. They just don't like it. So we're saying, what can we do to try and improve them? And some of the conditioning techniques that people use to encourage plants to be able to transition from a nice environment to a less favorable environment, like our vegetable garden, are things like withhold water for a couple days so that you put a little stress on them so that the plant kind of starts to slow up and will accept some of those more harsh conditions.
But you don't lay out there and pout.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. You know, you might say that. Yeah, all of a sudden you see those leaves starting to wilt downward, and that's kind of like a frown on your face. You know, that's not good. So water conditioning, I don't usually advocate that. Sometimes what we do is we put them outside during the day and they get exposure to bright sunlight and cooler conditions, and then we bring them in at night. So they kind of are transitioning between that, and we do that for several days, and that tends to slow them up a little bit, but also starts to condition them. And other techniques that we use is you can go in and actually physically brush the plant. You can take your hand and sweep it across the plant, and basically what you do is you start to move the plant, and that movement kind of simulates the windier conditions that are out there, and it tends to kind of strengthen the stem, slows the leaf from expanding as much, so it's the leaves don't grow as rapidly, and that also can condition them. And then sometimes what we also do is give the plant a little less to eat. So we're always watering it, but what we're doing is we're cutting back on the amount of fertilizer that we might be putting it into the seed mix and the soil mix. And as a result of that, that also helps condition it. So we do one of those things or multiple of those things, less water, less nutrients, a little cooler temperature, exposure to bright sunlight, maybe some stroking or brushing to kind of slow everything up, and then we transition it out into the vegetable garden, and that then helps it get itself ready to grow better under those types of conditions. Now,
should we talk to them?
Well, there are indicators that plants do respond to things in their environment. They respond to plants that are adjacent to them, and they may all be saying to each other, gosh, I'm cold. Gosh, Brian's been mean to me. Gosh, you know, I don't like this, so I'm not going to do what Brian wants me to do.
I'm half saying that tongue in cheek, but like, there are all of these things to do with these. I'm just like, I'm just going to plant you from seed. I'm not going to worry about coddling you this far along.
Well, that all works well and good, but there's reasons why we often transplant. One of them is we're putting a plant out that's 6 or 8 weeks old. So if you're not concerned about having tomatoes until the end of August or early September, yeah, plant your tomato seeds out there. Start today because you're going to wait till that.
So but a tomato is going to transition a lot easier than, say, a squash is going to.
Well, you're right. And that's something that we've discussed over the years, is that we have these plants that are cool weather plants, cold weather plants. So a spinach is a cold weather plant. We can put it out in the fall. It'll sit out there all winter. It'll start to grow in the spring. Kale is another one of those types of cold weather plants. Cool weather plants are things like onion and lettuce. You know, they can take a little bit, but if it gets really cold, then they often don't do so well. Then we have our warm weather plants that take a little bit more cold, and those are things like a tomato is a little bit hardier, but a close relative of it, the pepper, is very cold sensitive, so it's like a warm weather plant. And melons and your squash and those types of things are, you know, very sensitive to cold, and they don't like it at all. Yet, something like a winter squash, a squash plant in itself and a zucchini tends to take a little bit more of that, so you could actually do it. So there's all of these nuances within the plant families that we need to understand. And transplanting squash too early, transplanting your zucchini too early, or not giving it some type of protection can delay it from establishing and delay it from doing what we want it to do. Yet, all the evidence shows, all the research has shown that if we transplant a crop, we're going to get an earlier yield than we will if we plant a seed and we do them exactly at the same time, because that transplant is physiologically 4 or 5 weeks older, and therefore it's going to mature earlier, regardless of how much it struggles.
So there's the key, then, is not planting them indoors too early to let them get too far beyond what they should.
And that comes back to some of the rules that we have kind of indicated over the years. And I know last month when we were in, we missed some of our rules. And so I'm going to kind of go back to the first rule.
And you got to at least get to number three.
We will get to number three. We got an hour, but I'm going to go back to rule number one, because what you're talking about is seeding your zucchini out in the vegetable garden rather than transplanting it. So how do you decide where to place that seed, and are you putting it in the right location in the vegetable garden relative to what that plant wants? And essentially what we look at when we're looking at planting depth is you can take any object and put it in your palm of your hand, and the way that it kind of normally sits. So if you put a marble there, it's perfectly round. Basically, you're going to look at how tall that marble is, and that's how deep you're going to plant it, three times as deep as it is tall.
So even though a zucchini seed, it looks like a pretty good seed, but
it's a little flat, so it doesn't need to be really too deep. And in fact, what you're trying to do is if you put it on its side so that the broad part of it is, you would say, three times that depth, you're going to be putting it down at an inch or an inch and a quarter into the soil. Now, remember, the layers of soil have different temperature zones to them, and you're going to be putting it into an area that's quite cool relative to the surface, whereas if you put it on the way it normally sits flat in your hand, it's relatively thin. So three times the thickness of that, or three times the height of whatever way it sits in your hand, is the depth that you want to plant it at. So if it's a quarter of an inch, you actually maybe only want to plant it 3/4 of an inch deep, rather than if you use it the broad way, you would put it down at an inch and a quarter or an inch and a half. And therefore, it's going to be in a warmer zone, and it's going to germinate faster, and it's going to emerge more quickly as a result of being in the right location in the vegetable garden. So the 3X rule is all about starting from a seed and getting it in the right location. And if you think about very small seeds that we would be planting at this time, you know, continue to plant.
Like carrots. Carrots. You just be pressing them in.
They're very close to the surface. Okay. So, but that brings about other issues that we can talk about. But ideally, you want to get it in the right location, and then you're going to have a better opportunity of getting the thing established. And so the key of rule number one, which I call the 3X rule, is three times the height of the seed. That's the appropriate planting depth for it. And you can take any height. And so some are going to be deep, some are going to be shallower. And as a result of that, you're going to get a much, much better start.
Okay, so we've got that rule. What's number two?
Rule number two is what I call the 50% rule. Okay?
And I'll have these on the website.
Okay.
Right after the program.
That's good. 50% rule has to do with, now you were discussing earlier, you said, I'm giving up on my transplants. Now my question to you relates to the 50% rule. Are you growing the plant to the appropriate stage of maturity in the tray so that it can readily be moved out into your vegetable garden?
Are you kidding? I listened to the Zesty Garden.
Okay, but
and I've been interviewing me for 15 years. I wouldn't dare let those plants go beyond two true leaves.
Well, that's wrong. See?
It's wrong.
Yeah.
That's what you told me.
No, it comes down to the type of plant that you're dealing with again.
Okay. But that's with squash.
Okay, with squash. Yes. Okay. So that's true. Now, there's a good way to determine whether you're at the appropriate stage of growth or not. Because ideally what we want is we don't want to plant any transplant, vegetable transplant in particular, that is pot bound or root bound or cell tray bound or whatever container we're growing it in, so that it has such a massive root system in there that the plant is actually struggling because it's under the stress of trying to grow more roots in a very, very confined area. So the 50% rule relates to what's going on in the root system. And what we look for in a plant is it should have, if you would take that plant and pop it out of the container that it's growing in, whether it's a cell pack or any type of a 2-inch pot or a 3-inch pot, something like that, if you pull it out of that container, you should see on the outside of that, you should see 50% soil and 50% white roots. So essentially, you're kind of estimating, do I see, is the surface of that root ball got some roots there that will hold the soil together? And can I still see some soil media behind that?
So is that why you say, because you're not going to want to pull out a squash plant. So is that why you say two true leaves? Because that's about 50%?
No, because I'm actually going to pull one out to look. So I want to estimate because I want to get it at the right stage. And so oftentimes somewhere between what I say 1.5 true leaves and maybe up to 2.5 true leaves is that stage where it's 50% roots and 50% soil as I pull the plant out and just physically look at the root ball.
Now, is that one that you're not going to try and replant again?
I may.
Okay.
This is certainly useful when you go to a nursery or a garden center or something like that. You can pop a plant out of the cell. You look at them, they all look pretty uniform. But is it root bound or not? And when you pull it out, if it pulls out easy and it has 100% roots and I can't hardly see any soil, we would say that's pot bound.
And you see that a lot.
You see
especially like
that
broccoli,
a lot.
Cauliflower, cabbage.
Right.
Those that have been planted earlier just
because they've
packed.
Been growing for a long, long time. Now, those plants, when you put them out into the vegetable garden, often struggle because, A, they have so many roots that they don't really grow out of that into the surrounding soil. And you also do so much root damage when you're transplanting them, A, either through you manipulating the root ball, or B, because you think, it's pot bound, and therefore I'm going to treat it like I often do that. I'm going to tease those roots apart to try and encourage them to grow out. And in doing that, you're breaking, 20, 30, 40% of the roots, then the plant struggles because before it can start to regrow, it has to replace all the roots that you've damaged. Now, your broccoli plant when you do that, or your tomato plant when you do that, says, I can deal with that. I've stored enough energy in my stem. I've got a lot of leaves that are there, and I'm also a plant that grows roots quite rapidly. And as a result of that, it doesn't seem to bother it so much. But your squash plant, your melon plant, it does not like its roots disturbed. It does not like them teased apart. It does not like them broken. And it struggles as a result of that. So the 50% rule is all about trying to identify plants that are at the appropriate stage for transplanting out into our vegetable garden or our flower pots or wherever. And certainly for our annual plants, it works very, very well. And it's relatively easy to do. You just go in and you look and you pop a plant out and you say, wow, that thing has way too many roots. Then I would not be so rapid to purchase that. I would look around, see if there's ones that are a little younger, or talk to the nurseryman and say, I'm really looking for a slightly younger plant. Do you have any? And he may have them someplace else and he can go get them for you. Or you could say, I'm going to go someplace else to look for my plants. Now, that means that every place has the type of plant that you want. And sometimes we're forced to purchase plants that we maybe don't like. And then we have to make some decisions about root pruning or not.
Well, and then some of the issues that come to fore, even if you are purchasing a broccoli that's root bound, how long has it been root bound? Because then you get to a point where it never develops a large enough fruit.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And that's what often happens. The longer it sits in its container, the longer it's out there, the more stress it comes under. One of the responses that plants do as a result of being under those confined stresses is to flower prematurely, or to head out prematurely, or to maybe not head at all. So something like a cabbage, you might sometimes get these plants that they just kind of grow a bunch of leaves, but they never produce a cabbage head. A broccoli plant that never produces that floral structure that we want to consume. Or a tomato plant that, you know, very quickly goes to bloom. It sets some early fruits. The plant stays relatively compact throughout the summer, and it never gets the level of productivity that we want. And all of those are expressions by the plant of being under severe stress very early in their growing cycle. So by using the 50% rule, what you're going to do is you're going to be identifying plants that are more at an appropriate stage for being put out into the vegetable garden.
So the fifth, we have the 3x rule and the 50% rule.
That's correct.
So what's number three?
It is called the one finger rule. Okay, now don't misinterpret that.
Whose finger?
It's your index finger and your thumb are the fingers that you're going to use. Now, when you grab that transplant and you said, I've identified ones that are at the 50%, and by 50%, it's a kind of a sliding scale. Yeah. You know, 40% is probably okay. 60% is okay. You know, you just don't want ones that are 80, 90, 100% roots and no soil that you can see through that. So when you grab that plant, you tend to grab it by the stem right around the soil line, and you pop it out of the tray. When you hold it in your hand, you have your thumb and your index finger that are holding that. That's how much soil you should put on top of the root ball when you transplant it. So I call it the one finger rule.
So the width of your finger.
The width of your finger as you're holding it, you should put that much soil over top of it. And for 90% of our vegetables, essentially that will leave the cotyledons or the seed leaves at the surface of the soil. So another way, sometimes you'll find plants that are slightly etiolated or elongated, and the stem section from the soil line to the seed leaves is a little bit long. And for all of the vegetables that we transplant, we effectively want to leave the seed leaves above the soil line. So the one finger rule allows us to do that. So you can think of the width of your index finger, or I like to say you grab it with your thumb and your index finger to pull it out of the tray, and you're holding it close
as you're doing the 50% rule.
Yes, that's how much soil you should put over the root ball, because you don't want the root ball to dry out. You actually want it to be below ground, because it's a very different media than the soil is, and it can dry out quite rapidly when you do that. And so by putting them in that right depth, that's also going to help with your rapid establishment. Most of the root ball is going to be in relatively warm soil. You're going to water it anyway after you transplant it to help it establish better. And oftentimes when we're taking water from our tap or something like that, it's pretty cold. So we're actually lowering the soil temperature in that proximity to those plants, but it will warm back up. But you're getting it at the right position again.
Now, we do have a caller, but I wanted to ask real quick, what I like to do, especially if it's warmer, is to put a little layer of, like, say, peat moss. Mm-hmm. Peat moss on the top to hold the moisture in. Am I actually keeping it too cool?
You can with that. So, you don't need to do that. Ideally, what we would like is that soil to rewarm back up quite quickly, because that helps with root growth. The soil temperature is more favorable for root growth when we keep it at or close to what we consider ideal. And when you put icy cold water, which comes out of your tap, it's coming out of our culinary systems, or if you have canal-based systems or an irrigation system that supplies water to you, you know, check the temperature on it. It's pretty cold, and then you add all of that water into the soil, and that drops that soil temperature, and that can have a negative effect on how the plant will grow. So sometimes some gardeners will actually get tepid water, so it's a reasonably warm. We use mulches underneath it, but plastic mulches to warm the soil up even more, and then we add water that's a little bit warm. And in the vegetable garden, you can kind of do that because you're dealing with a limited number of plants, and it's not going to be that hard to try and keep that soil temperature from being depressed too much, because roots don't grow out into that cold environment either, and that slows it up. Yet the top of the plant is up where it's warm. The sun is beating on it. It wants to transpire. It wants to lose water. And if it can't pick up the water from the soil because it's so cold, then that puts stress on the plant as well.
Okay, we have a caller from Salt Lake. We have Scott on the line. Hi, Scott. How can we help?
Hi, I was wondering, I have a problem with grubs, and I don't know if they migrated from the lawn. I don't know if they migrated from the garden to the lawn. Where do they come from? How do I get rid of them?
Well, grubs are kind of there all the time. We can, you know, put some soil-based insecticides in proximity to our transplants if we're putting plants out into the vegetable garden. In your lawn, unless you're having a real serious problem with patchiness where the grass just does not grow very well, then you're going to have to treat it. And I usually don't recommend particular insecticides here. That's something that you're going to have to go to your nursery or your garden center for and get those products that are for lawn grubs. And if you have them in your vegetable garden, then what you want to look at is the label to make sure that they're also acceptable to be used on your vegetables. Now, that's kind of a soil in a grub that might be associated with a beetle or something like that. We also have a moth-based worm that lives in the soil that we often see at this time of the year, which is called cutworms. And cutworms generally are a larval stage of a moth, and they kind of burrow down into the soil during the day when it's bright and hot. They don't like to be up on the surface. And then at night, they come back up, and they either chew on the stem or they might chew on some of the lower leaves of early planted vegetables like spinach and lettuce and maybe some of your broccoli or cabbage. And once again, what you can do is use one of the insecticidal dusts for those and put that on the plants. And so when they come up to feed, they're going to consume some of that insecticide, and that will then correct the problem there.
So you mean, do cutworms, do they both go for the roots or...
Cutworms generally will feed on roots, but oftentimes they come up and eat on leaf tissue or stem tissue, and they do that at night. So you don't often see them. You just see the results of it. And as a result, if you know they're feeding on roots because you don't see any leaf damage, then it's probably one of the ground grubs that is doing that, and you're still going to have to drench with some type of insecticide, or you're going to have to put a dry material on and water it in so that that insecticide gets into the soil. And there are many, many different products, and that's why I don't suggest any particular one. If you go to your nursery or landscape and look for grub control, but that's why you need to identify what it is first before you do it, because some chemicals work better for grubs and some work better for cutworms and those types of insects.
Well, they're definitely getting their roots, and I've dug up a couple of grubs. So you're saying they're just in the soil all the time?
They're in the soil all the time. Yeah, I have a lot of them in my lawn, and you know, if you keep your cut on your lawn a little bit higher, I find that even though they're there and I dig them up when I'm, you know, kind of spading around in there, they really don't do a whole lot of damage because I got a lot of vigorous grass growth. If you're cutting your lawn really shallow and short, then it's more expressive because the plant can't overcome the ability of it and grow the roots to replace the ones that the grubs are eating. And so I never test for it, even though I have them.
Okay.
Okay?
All right, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks, Scott. And we'll also have Diane Alston will be on next week, and we can discuss more of the insect issues.
Yeah, I think that would be
like
good
that,
because, so. You know, we start seeing some of those at this time of the year. And the reason I don't make recommendations on various pesticides is because I found that that just by keeping my lawn mowed a little tall, yeah, the plant is really vigorous, and it actually, you don't hardly see any ill effects of it. You don't see brown patching, even though when I start digging around or I cut out another section of lawn because I'm expanding a flower garden and I'm kind of knocking the roots out of the soil because I want to keep the soil. I just don't want to throw things out. And I go, wow, there's quite a bit of grubs in here. I might find, you know, one or two per shovelful of soil and sod, but I can't really tell any ill effect on the lawn.
Yeah,
so.
I've heard Diane say, and actually Kelly Cope,
yeah,
talk about mowing the lawn high, water less frequently, but water more deeply.
Yeah.
And those roots tend to.
Well, I followed that advice, and the plants are just, they're vigorous, and I don't have brown patches, but I often see people with brown patches when they try to cut their lawn too short and do some of those other things, or water every day. Boy, that just favors the growth of all kinds of problems.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and then Dan Drost will be back, and we hope you'll call in with your questions or comment. It's 1-800-826-1495, or you can go online and send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. We'll be right back. Hello. Welcome back to the second half of the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And in studio with me today is Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. But before we get back to Dan, we're going to have a couple of items here from our gardening calendar. Logan City is inviting volunteers to help with planting along the Logan River this Saturday, starting at 10 a.m. They'll start at the stretch of Logan River between the Center Street and 100 North Bridges. They'll have bare root stock consisting of water birch, currants, and other species that they want to plant. Any and all volunteers to assist with planting are welcome. Just meet at 10 o'clock between the Center and 100 North Bridges in Logan. And then the Logan Library has a Lunch and Learn series every single week. And this week, May 7th, is a permaculture and garden farming with Josh Choate, a natural philosopher. All you've got to do is bring a lunch and they'll bring the learning. That's every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. in the Lake Bonneville room of the Logan Library, and that is free and open to the public. All right, Dan, so we've been talking about your rules. Let's go to number four. We've had one, two, and three. The last one, the finger rule. What's number four?
Well, if you're thinking about transplanting, we already alluded to the fact that you're trying to create a warm environment for those plants to grow in. You want to try and think about your greenhouse or the greenhouse environment that you purchase plants in, and then you bring them out into the vegetable garden, and they get to a much less favorable environment. So gardeners tend to lay plastic mulches and plant through plastic. They stick a hot cap or a milk jug or a wall of water or a row cover or something on it. And what their goal is to bring the temperature back up toward what the greenhouse was so that the plant gets established really quickly. However, what happens? Normally, we know that the temperature fluctuates during the day, right? It's going to be cold overnight, and the sun comes out. The environment warms up due to all that shortwave radiation we receive. And then you put a structure around it that encloses the environment for the plant, so a wall of water. I noticed some people had wall of waters out already. I'm assuming they have warm weather vegetables in there, like a tomato or a pepper or something like that. And then the top is completely closed, and that water absorbs all that radiation during the day. And the idea is that it is supposed to re-radiate that heat that's stored in the water from a wall of water back around the plant during the cold of the night. But it's during the day that's equally important for it. And so the fourth rule that we use is what I call the 30-plus rule. So we had the 3X rule, we had the 50% rule, we had the one-finger rule, and now we have the 30-plus rule. And the 30-plus rule essentially states that the temperature inside a closed environment out in your vegetable garden, like a milk jug or a wall of water, something that the air is not being exchanged in, is 30 degrees warmer than the outside air temperature. So if today in Logan they're predicting temperatures of 60 degrees, the temperature inside your wall of water at noon to 3 o'clock in the afternoon is going to be 90 degrees. If it's on the weekend they're talking 70 or 75 degrees, now the 30-plus rule says that the temperature inside that structure is well over 100 degrees. And plants don't like those high temperatures. So what you need to be thinking about when you're dealing with a structure over top of a plant, whether it's a high tunnel, whether it's a low tunnel, whether it's a milk jug, whether it's a
clear plastic to try to germinate the seeds.
Right. The temperature underneath that is going to be in excess sometimes of the temperature of outside by 30 degrees or more. And we're okay if it's 50 out. We're okay if it's 60 out. When it gets above 60, that problems start to happen, and then plants are under stress. So the idea is you want to create a favorable environment, but that means you also have to manage the structure. So we've got an experiment going where we have low tunnels over top of asparagus plants out in the research farm, and we're monitoring spear growth and spear temperatures. And we have a bright sunny day like today, and we've been looking at those temperatures. The spear temperature of that asparagus plant on a day like today where it's going to be 60 is, you know, the temperature under the structure is well in excess of 90 plus degrees. And for asparagus, that's too warm. It makes the spear grow too fast. It also causes the tip of the asparagus spear to open up and flower earlier. And all of those things affect the quality of the spear. And so you have to be thinking about that. And if you have a flowering plant, like a tomato or something like that, the leaf is okay at 90 degrees, but you want early bloom. I don't eat tomato leaves. I eat tomato fruits. So you need to have a flower. And if the flower temperature goes above 90 degrees, then we start seeing bad things happen, which next month we'll talk more about. But for tomato right now, you want to get that thing established. You want it to get growing vigorously. So maybe actually 90 degrees is okay, because you might want to abort or kill off all those early flowers so that you get your plant to generate more energy into leaves and stems so that you have higher productivity later on.
So let's talk about tomatoes. Can you eat a tomato leaf?
It's very bitter. I have tried. Yes, because they say, you know, it has these alkaloids in it that give it a very strong and bitter flavor, and I don't recommend it.
Are they related to nightshade?
Yes.
Nightshade family?
That's right.
So some nightshades, of course, are very,
very
poisonous.
And it's those alkaloids that are there. And they're different alkaloids, but they still have a bitter flavor to it. And so when you bite into it, you kind of go, ugh, it's got a really strong, bitter flavor. And it's those compounds, those alkaloids that are there that makes you not want to eat it, whereas the fruit itself, that's a different story.
Well, we've only got about 4 minutes left.
Well, we
want
to talk a little about tomatoes. So, I mean, we have been talking about tomatoes. I mean, you know, ideally what you're trying to do at this time of the year is buy a nice plant, a healthy tomato plant. You want to create a warm environment for it out in the vegetable garden, so plastic mulch is on the soil surface, heating the soil up so that the roots grow out into it, and you're going to put some type of structure over the top of it, a wall of water, a hot cap, a milk jug, a low tunnel, some floating row cover, or something like that. All of those things create a warmer environment around the plant's leaves so that it can photosynthesize more and it can grow big and healthy and produce those early fruits that we want, because if I planted a seed today, I wouldn't get a fruit until late August, maybe mm-hmm. early September, and I wouldn't get very much productivity. But if I do a transplant, I might have tomatoes by late July or early July, depending on what variety I select. And so from a tomato perspective, you got a couple options that are there. And so when you look at it, you really need to pay attention to the genetics. So if you want some really early tomatoes, you need to buy a variety that says it's an early variety, and usually that's in the name. An example would be Early Girl. It's a very early variety. Now, if you buy beef steak types, those are actually quite late maturing. And so, yes, establish them now, but they're going to produce most of their fruit a little bit later in the season.
Or like Brandywine, an heirloom.
Very late maturing. Yeah. And so, you know, sometimes we love them, but they're not quite as productive as we would like, or they don't start as early as we'd like. So all of those things, in effect, what I was talking about all morning long, you just put tomato into every one of those sections, and you've basically talked about tomatoes, what we need to do. And so the ideal conditions right now are to warm that soil, put something around it, but also to manage what's around it. So a floating row cover, it doesn't get the 30 degrees under there. You're probably okay with that, but it might not be as warm as we would like during the day. If you've got a wall of water, you may actually physically have to open it up during the day in order to kind of get some of that heat out of there so that the plant isn't under extra stress, and then close it up again at night.
So we've got, and we can talk a little more in depth about this, but my own tomatoes love to be mulched. They don't like going dry and then going wet. I don't usually have any problem with blossom end rot because I keep them evenly moist. Is there a better mulch, or does it pretty much anything work?
Pretty much anything will work. And seeing as we don't really need to water too much right now, mostly what we have to manage is temperature. Right now. Next month, what we're going to do is we're going to talk more about tomatoes and squashes and all of these other crops that need to kind of create a nice uniform environment for them. Right now, you want to create a nice uniform warm environment and not worry about the water, because water isn't our big problem right now. It's temperatures that's our big problem. Next month, we're going to start talking more about water and nutrients to make sure that that plant is growing vigorously, because if you do what you're supposed to do right now, the plant will be fine for the next month. Come the 1st of June, it's the 1st of May, the 1st of June, we're going to really start to think about managing that plant in a different way, and so I think we're going to hold off for that till next month.
Okay. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and he's back the first Thursday of every month, and we'll have him back next month. Coming up next is the next segment for Petals and Pros. You'll learn about tulips from Helen Cannon.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Pros, and I've been trying with my small contributions to talk about springtime flowers. So you might remember that I talked about daffodils and hyacinths. And today, and perhaps the next time, I would like to talk about tulips. The story of the tulip is about a flower that made men mad. Greed, desire, anguish, devotion have all played their part in the development of the tulip from a wildflower of the Asian steppes to the worldwide phenomenon it is today. The U.S. alone imports 3,000 million tulip bulbs each year, Germany and France even more. Why did the tulip dominate so many lives through so many centuries in so many countries? No other flower has ever carried so much cultural baggage. It charts political upheavals, illuminates social behavior, mirrors economic booms and busts, plots the ebb and flow of religious persecution. The tulip made great fortunes for people, but it was responsible for equally spectacular bankruptcies. Millions of aficionados now gaze in awe at the brilliant flower pieces painted in the early 17th century by Dutch master painters. But at the time they were painted, these works of art were considered as cheap substitutes for the real flowers. Roaming through Asia, India, Russia, and the Ottoman Empire, we learn, as we study the tulip, how it arrived from Turkey and took the whole of Western Europe by storm. When I decided to talk about the tulip, I dug out books in our plant library, and so I will be using primarily a book called The Tulip by Anna Pivord, and also another book called Tulipomania by Mike Dash and a section of Michael Pollan's The Botany of Desire and a little bit from Mirabelle Osler's A Gentle Plea for Chaos. If you were to look into the history of tulips, you would learn that in Amsterdam in 1637, for the cost of a single tulip bulb, you could buy 4 oxen or 12 sheep or 24 tons of wheat or 2 hogsheads of wine or 2 tons of butter or 4 barrels of beer or 1,000 pounds of cheese or a silver drinking cup or an oak bed or a ship. Well, that financial situation soon changed dramatically. As far as Western Europe is concerned, this tulip story began in Turkey, from where in the mid-16th century European travelers brought back news of the brilliant and until then unknown Lille Rouge. They thought it was a lily, so prized by the Turks. In fact, they were not lilies at all, but tulips. In April 1559, the Zurich physician and botanist Conrad Gesner saw the tulip flowering for the first time in the splendid gardens made by the Emperor of Bavaria. He described its gleaming red petals and its sensuous scent in a book published 2 years later, the first known report of the flower growing in Western Europe. The tulip, wrote Gesner, had sprung from a seed which had come from Constantinople, or as others say, from that flower and from its wild cousins gathered over the next 300 years from the steppes of Siberia, from Afghanistan, Beirut, the Crimea, and the Caucasus, and from the Marmaris Peninsula. More than 5,500 different tulips are listed in the International Register published regularly since 1929. Holland was the setting for one of the strangest episodes in the long, mesmerizing story of the tulip. Tulipomania that raged in Holland between 1634 and 1637 has puzzled historians and economists ever since. How could it ever have happened that single bulbs of certain kinds of tulips could change hands for sums that would have secured a townhouse in the best quarter of Amsterdam? How was it possible that at the height of the tulip fever, a bulb weighing 2.15 azen could sell for 5,400 guilders, the equivalent of 15 years' wages for an average Amsterdam bricklayer? Certain facts are brought forward to support less certain theories. The setting up of the Dutch East India Company in 1602 and Amsterdam's increasing importance as a port marked the beginning of an era of great prosperity for the Dutch. Merchants became rich, and in their wake, lawyers, doctors, pharmacists, and jewelers did too. The house of one of the keepers of the tulips grew clustered around a mirrored gazebo. The mirrors gave the illusion that the hundreds of blooms were thousands. This book, The Tulip by Anna Pivard, does explain these money denominations, so we have a clearer picture of how it relates to the dollar. She tells about how one of the bulbs, Semper Augustus, the most beautifully marked of all red and white striped tulips of the early 17th century, how by the 1640s, when tulipomania was critically over, there were thought to be only 12 bulbs of Semper Augustus still in existence, priced at 12,000 guilders each. This was the equivalent of 3 times the average wage in 17th century Holland. If you could not afford the flowers themselves, you commissioned an artist to paint the tulips for you. And so a lot of the masterpieces in Dutch flower painting came into being at this time. The last of the big spenders bid at an auction of tulip bulbs, 99 lots which realized 90,000 guilders, perhaps as much as 6 million pounds in today's money. Because the sale was held in February, the waits recorded, you didn't know what the flower would look like. She tells about how when some of these precious bulbs were shipped, the person unpacking them thought it was an onion, put salt and pepper on it, and ate it. So tulip lovers were not that well informed. Some of them weren't. And at that time, some of the most beautiful tulips with striations and beautiful color changes were the tulips that they called breaks. Turned out that these tulips, so gorgeous in their stripes and interesting patterns, were actually afflicted by a virus, aphids that were really making them much too weak to be viable. And they didn't know this at the time, so a lot of the breaks were sold at very high prices. The very word virus was not understood in the modern sense until the 1880s. Only the advent of the electron microscope in the late 1920s gave researchers the necessary means to unravel its true nature. And just by the evidence of their own inquiring eyes, early growers had 1,000 theories about the best way to bring about this magical break. Some charlatans sold miracle recipes for the purpose. At that time, some fools bought them. Pigeon dung was a favorite catalyst, they said. Plaster from old walls and water that ran down from dung hills. Some growers, taking their cue from contemporary alchemists' own attempts to turn base metal into gold, tried to transmute the flowers. Indeed, it was rather better, for while the alchemists consistently failed in their endeavors, it seemed that tulip growers occasionally succeeded. They just didn't know why. When they finally discovered that aphids were the vectors, the carriers of the virus from bulb to bulb, those tulips lost their worth. Unfortunately, the break tulips are no longer available. There are so many, many more things that could be said about the tulip. Well, this is my story. Perennially, I have too much and too little time. But I hope next time I come to you through Petals and Prose, we'll talk again about the tulip. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com.
This is KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL Richfield, KUSK Vernal, KUSR Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.